Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Focus on Business Radio is a program dedicated to maximizing your business success through interviews with subject matter experts, information on critical aspects of starting and doing business, and providing insights through shared success stories. While no two businesses are exactly alike, successful businesses share common characteristics. Those characteristics are what we explore in each program. I'm Lee Strickland, your host from Focus Resources. I am an entrepreneur, a small business owner for over 15 years, an author, a columnist, and a subject matter expert on business. I built my business from scratch in 2002 with no business contacts in this area to a nationally recognized resource for business startups, entrepreneurs, government contractors, and grant recipients, and the media. Each day, I bring to my clients and readers practical information on how to build a profitable, thriving business, whether it is a traditional brick-and-mortar mom-and-pop business or an innovative startup spinning out of a university. Now, the comments, views, and opinions on this program are educational and do not reflect the views of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. The information shared is not meant to replace specific advisory services for your business. Always consult with qualified, experienced, and reputable business and legal advisors before making any decision impacting your business. And now it's time to focus on your business. Today's topic is crowdfunding and investor protection in North Carolina, and my guest is John Marin, Director of Investor Protection and Education Services Programs for the North Carolina Department of Secretary of State. John is responsible for a comprehensive and multifaceted public outreach program designed to raise public awareness of fraud while promoting efficient use of business capital. The outreach is made to the general investing public, the financial services professionals who serve the public, the law enforcement community, legal professionals, and members of the armed services. The outreach program is conducted through personal appearances, like today, through articles written in the newspapers, newsletters, trade journals, etc., as well as through interviews with the broadcast media. During the past 12 years, John has led a team that has planned, conducted, or participated in over 1,250 speaking events, reaching over 72,000 citizens, and has built a mailing list from zero to nearly 6,000 members. If you need to reach John, you can send him an email with a proposed date, time, location, and approximate audience size to jmaron, that's M-A-R-O-N, at sosnc.gov, and include a daytime phone number where you can be reached. John, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you, Lee. It's great to be here.
Well, and we are going to talk a little bit about crowdfunding in North Carolina, get an update on that. And then we also want to talk about investor protection and why that's important to understand from a business perspective, and then what the investor really needs to know about what you guys do and what they need to be aware of. So kind of just start us with an update on the crowdfunding, on the PACES Act, and what all is going on in North Carolina.
Sure. Happy to. Crowdfunding in North Carolina is really starting to gain some traction. We've, as you know, the original law, the North Carolina PACES Act, was signed into law by Governor McCrory back in July of 2016. And then the Secretary of State's office was tasked with the responsibility of promulgating the rules, which we did. And those became fully effective as of April 1st of 2017. So we're just over a year now, with the law and the statutes, being in place, ready to go. Since then, we've had lots of ongoing conversations with a lot of interested parties, both from the business side, the issuers, as well as some of the support, the infrastructural support, like attorneys and a funding portal. We now have a funding portal that's been approved, as well as a registered broker dealer has also been approved. So we have all of the support mechanisms in place, and we've been talking with some issuers, and we think we're getting close to having some actual activity, some real crowdfunding activity here in the state. So we're We think this is a very interesting form of capital financing. It will bring, hopefully, lots of good opportunities, both for small businesses that are wanting to sort of get out of off the drawing board and maybe out of the garage, and giving investors, mom and pop retail investors, a chance to maybe get in on something that might ultimately be a new technology, new service, new product, you know, something. So
we're new options, all those kinds of things.
Exactly, yeah. So we're very excited, and we're interested in talking with folks about this, people, you know, issuers, businesses that are looking to get started. We have some great people in our office that are extremely and willing to talk with folks. So.
And so when should they reach out to you? When they just have the idea that they think they might want to go down this path, and so that they learn what the process is? When's the
That's certainly fine. We do encourage, you know, in order to be efficient with our time and our services, we have wonderful, well-written, very easy to understand, frequently asked questions, FAQs about crowdfunding, on our website. And our website is www.sosnc.gov, Secretary of State, North Carolina.gov. And you'll click on the division link and look for securities. And then there you'll find crowdfunding. And we have a tab for FAQs. And as I said, they are written in. I mean, we spent a lot of time because taking the law, taking the regulations, right, and boiling them down into something useful that the average person can use and understand took a lot of time. And we have written them from multiple perspectives. We have FAQs for issuers. We have FAQs for investors. We have general FAQs. We have FAQs for the funding portals that
right,
that have to, you know, what their responsibilities are. And so we really encourage, if somebody is thinking about crowdfunding as a business financing method, we urge them to take some time first to maybe read the statute, because we have linked to the statute,
right,
on our page as well. You know, it's always good to read and then certainly spend time with our FAQs and read through those, so that at least you'll have an understanding. You'll know better what questions to ask, and because you'll have a little bit of a framework for that and understanding. But you know, we do know that people want to call and have questions, and that's fine. But we do encourage people to do a little homework first.
Right. And I'll link to that on the FocusOnBusinessRadio.com website.
That'd be great.
And so everyone can re-listen to the podcast later, and then they can check out the links and get that basic education, so that there's a more informed question period with your most valuable resources. So when we're thinking about this, and you said there's a broker-dealer now, and then there's a portal, and why is that a good thing that we now have those in North Carolina, and what will they be doing, and what's their role?
Underlying tenets of both federal and state crowdfunding is that you do these things through a web portal, an authorized, registered portal. The Jobs Act, the federal law, has stipulations that you know, all of the federal-based crowdfunding has to go through an approved SEC funding portal. And I believe that there are now 42 sanctioned portals, something
right,
like that, with more sort of in the works. So the reason why is because that's the method of communication between the issuer and the potential investors, and between the investors who are considering, you know, which crowdfunding offering they might be interested in. And so the term crowdfunding sort of comes from the sense of the wisdom of the crowd will help guide, you know, an investor to you know, maybe an investment opportunity that may have some, you know, legs, so to speak.
Right.
So means then that an issuer can put their offering out there for investors. We have to have a funding portal or go through a registered broker dealer. Those are the two ways that you do those. Now we can talk a little bit about, you know, the wrinkle that is in the North Carolina law that's unique to North Carolina.
Right.
But essentially you have to go through a funding portal or through a registered broker dealer in order to list your offering.
And those portals and the broker dealer help with the process and the systems that are the compliance elements
right.
of when you're going to do the issuing of the stock or whatever right. instrument that is.
Right. You post all of your offering documentation on the portal so that the crowd can review them and comment on them. And you have to have a sort of a messaging component. The portal has to have a messaging component so that the crowd can ask questions of the issuer, and the answers are posted in such a way that the crowd can read them, and then the crowd can also discuss the relative merits or demerits of the offering.
Okay, so what is that little wrinkle you alluded to with the North Carolina law?
Okay.
Let's go to that.
North Carolina has the crowdfunding has essentially two parts. There is the NCPO, the North Carolina public offering, which basically is similar to the federal crowdfunding. We are a little bit more generous in North Carolina. The federal law caps the amount that you can raise in a 12-month period to a little over $1 million. I think it's 1.07 with the adjustment of
right.
inflation or whatever. So 1.07 million is what the feds, the federal crowdfunding law allows you to raise. North Carolina, we allow up to $2 million in a 12-month period under the NCPO offering.
So does that mean it has, since there's a difference between federal and state, that means you're operating within the intrastate crowdfunding to do that $2
million? Yeah, you're exactly. And what we should probably explain a little bit about to folks is what we're talking about is an exemption from registration. Generally speaking, both federal and state law requires a business, an issuer, to either register themselves as an issuer with the SEC under federal laws or with the state under state issuances, for one of many different exemptions that are available to issuers. Crowdfunding, both federal and state, is just one example of an exemption available to issuers. And you qualify for the exemption, you know, by adhering to the terms of the exemption.
Right.
Okay. So the federal crowdfunding exemption is $1 million and change. That's how much you can raise in a 12-month period. North Carolina's exemption says, you know, you can raise up to $2 million. Now, the wrinkle I mentioned is that, as I said, that there is this North Carolina public offering, but we also have what is known as a local public offering, and NCLPO, essentially. We try to make it really, really easy for the truly small business to be able to access financing capital. And what the LPO option exemption allows is for those issuers who are looking to raise no more than $250,000 in a 12-month period. We make the regulation really kind of simple for them. We ask that before they do any kind of issuings or any kind of offerings, they have to schedule an appointment with our office, with our representatives, and bring in copies of all the advertising material that they wish to do.
Right.
And we have to approve those materials beforehand, and we have to have a little chat, kind of tell them what they can and can't do,
right.
what the rules of the road are. But if they agree and they satisfy the conditions and, you know, agree to the terms of what they're legally allowed to do with their advertising, then they can go out on the street corner with a sign.
They can do a sandwich board and march
exactly,
up and down.
Exactly. Say, invest with me.
Right.
You can hand out flyers at your church Sunday school.
Did they come onto the radio show?
They can come on the radio show. They can advertise. And that, you know, advertising has long been sort of a key element to securities regulation,
right,
and what you can and can't do via general solicitation. And by virtue of you plugging into a computer or hearing my voice on the radio or seeing my beautiful face on a billboard, all that sort of constitutes general solicitation. And so there's specific rules about,
right,
what you can and can't do under the different exemptions. But with the – and I don't want to muddy the waters,
right,
too much with this. But with the LP option is that if you come in, schedule the meeting, abide by the terms, and let us approve everything, then again, you can go out and generally solicit up to $250,000.
So here's a question, and if it's too detailed for on the show, that's fine. We'll link to an FAQ or something. What happens if I raise $250,000 that positioned me and it turned on more money than I thought and more interest in what I'm doing? And I thought, now I decide I want to go to the $2 million level, but I did that first $250,000 local public offering. Now what happens? Do I come back to you and guys say, hey, look, I turned this on. I only thought I was going to do $250,000 and I was going to go on this, you know, longer time frame, and that would have been fine. But now I need, I can access $2 million. It's going to make it go faster. And what do I do?
Yeah. Well, it is possible to do multiple types of fundraising issuances. But really the key is making sure you're not commingling the money.
Okay.
So that the money's raised under, are kept separate under the different issuance.
So I could come in, I think I'm going to do the $250,000, right, less than that. I get everything approved and I do it and I get that. And we hit home runs on everything that we were going to do with our prototype or whatever it is. And that one's closed out, but now I want to do another one, but I'm still within that 12-month window.
Yeah, well, and here's where some of the technical aspects of it may require somebody back in my office sort of weighing in. But my understanding is that the 12-month period is limited to the initial
– it being open.
To the ask,
okay,
you know, to the original ask. You've got 12 months to raise your $250,000.
Okay. If I do it –
at least raise your minimum amount,
right,
whatever the minimum floor is. But you can transition into other types of, issuances under different exemptions. And so
so it'll be a good problem to have to sit down with you.
And as you said at the top of the show, we really, really, really do strongly encourage, even though crowdfunding, both federal and state, is meant to make things easier for the small business to access capital through crowdfunding, and therefore there is no requirement in the statutes or the rules that you obtain an attorney, the services of an attorney. But we always, always, always stress and encourage people to consider finding a licensed attorney in North Carolina who is experienced in securities law, because, you know, securities law is really unforgiving. There's no intent. Intent doesn't matter. You either are compliant or you're not compliant.
Right.
And
it's binary.
Exactly. And so we really don't want people to get themselves in a bind inadvertently, and it's very easy to do. And so we do strongly encourage people to seriously consider talking to an experienced, licensed North Carolina attorney in securities.
Well, I think that's a good transition, too, into the broader conversation of investor protection and what's the expectation, mm-hmm, of the issuer, on them, on what information they're providing, what the expectation is, what's your homework going to be working with that attorney, and then throughout the life of your now relationship with an investor or potential investor, what does that look like, and how are you guys engaged in that education process, plus what is it the issuer needs to know and what potential investors need to know?
Sure. Good question. And again, as you alluded at the top of the hour, you know, my agency has dual responsibility. We have a responsibility to administer and enforce the state securities laws. And those laws govern how businesses can raise money legally and what responsibilities they have, the different professionals in the business, the issuers, as well as the broker-dealers, investment advisors, what their legal obligations are to investors. Because the basic tenet of securities law is investor protection, that the investor has a right to know any and all material information about an investment, about the offers, about the issuers, before they part with the first dime of their money. And so the rules and regulations that are in place are designed, you know, with that intention, and they can be seen sometimes as being burdensome to issuers and to businesses. But I like to put things into perspective, and I sort of talk to when I'm talking to business groups or issuers about these kinds of things. I say, all right, let's pretend now that you are an investor. You're going to invest in somebody else's business, a crowdfunding business or any other type of thing.
Right.
You know, what information would you want to know in order to make an informed decision? And that's sort of what the rules and regulation and the statutes sort of get at, is that the investor is entitled to this information, and you have to be open and transparent. You cannot materially omit any relevant information that would be required to, you know, the investor making an informed decision. So that's sort of the message that that we try to project to both to the issuers as well as to the investors, to sort of just maybe help demystify some of this stuff.
And so when we're talking about investors, are we always talking about high net worth accredited investors, or are we also talking about the unaccredited investors, and how right. do each get to play in this?
Both in some ways. The law has some flexibility built into it for issuers who are looking to deal with high net worth. And when we talk about high net worth, we're talking about people that have incomes above $1 million, excluding their primary residence. People are broadly defined as accredited
right.
investors. And the idea is that these individuals, these high-worth individuals, have the means to obtain competent advice and counsel when making a decision, an investment decision.
In other words, they can afford to get qualified advisors.
They can afford to get the attorneys or CPAs
accountants.
Or accountants,
yeah.
you know, or broker-dealer or investment advisor. They can afford those professional services to get counsel. With unaccredited investors, those with incomes less than $1 million, have quite that same level of access. It's harder for them. And so there are some wrinkles in the law. Some of the exemptions apply to issuers who are looking to only solicit high net worth individuals. There are some elements of those exemptions which, you know, say that they can raise unlimited amount of money. They can advertise to those individuals, but they can only sell to those high net worth people, and they have to take some due diligence to obtain that information.
And again, and that's the portal helps with that.
In the
money type things.
Yeah.
And the broker dealer should be helping in the compliance aspects of that, or your securities attorney. Someone's there in that process as an issuer that is helping you manage that process and keep you on the straight and narrow. Sometimes it's your business consultant. And I don't think that person in the room matches that criteria.
Yeah.
So With that, I'm going to call it arbitrary, that $1 million net worth, you might see someone that, you know, has more sophistication and understanding investments and the risks and things and be below that level.
Sure.
But that's the level the government has set as the regulatory limit. And so those exceptions, are there exceptions to, say, some of the crowdfunding under the PACES Act or whether that you can take on unaccredited and non-accredited investors?
Yeah. The federal law has sort of a complex formula for figuring out there are how much an individual investor can invest in a crowdfunded issuance. And it's based on a rather complex little formula based on your net worth. And
it's a government formula. Complex formula.
You're able to invest, I think the limit is, no more than 5,000 in a single, offering, but there's not a limit on how many offerings you can do. I think I'm right on that. I'd have to.
We'll look at the FAQ. It'll be on focusonbusinessradio.com, and we'll do some linking there to the information on the SEC website also. So when we're thinking about this as an investor, if we wanted your office to come in and do an investor education program for one of our groups, what does that look like? How much notice do we have to give you? Do we pick a topic? Do you come in and do a general one?
Great flexibility in my schedule. My primary job is to do exactly this kind of stuff, and I go all over the state. I appreciate you mentioning at the top. I think we're actually closing in about 1,300 presentations. We've been in all 100 counties. I don't know if your broadcast reach is into Northampton. I'd love to get back there. I think we've been there once, but we'd love to get back there again. But no. You know, we talk on a variety of topics. I do a presentation from the perspective of businesses, like we're talking here. I do presentations from the perspective of investors. Sometimes I mix the two, depending on how much time people are willing to sit and listen to me talk. We often will also bring in related topics that the Secretary of State's office deals with as well. I mean, what your listeners how they may know us more rather than securities is through our business registration division.
Right.
State agency that you go to in order to actually form your legal entity, you come to the Secretary of State's office to register. So Secretary of State's office from that perspective,
right.
and only later maybe learn about securities or other elements. But some other elements of the office that sort of tie into this is our charitable solicitation licensing division for nonprofit organizations. We also are the notary enforcement entity here in the state. We administer and enforce the state's notaries public law. And we also have responsibility for trademark enforcement, intellectual property enforcement. Here in the state of North Carolina. And unlike a lot of the Secretary of State's office has, in many instances, both civil administrative authority as well as criminal enforcement authority. In securities, for instance, we do have fellows and ladies who carry guns and badges. Trademarks, the same thing. We have sworn law officers there. We are We're a very small agency. We're probably one of the smallest state agencies in state government. But we have a reach and a punch that is tremendous to the state. I mean, we provide critical infrastructure support to our North Carolina businesses. We have millions, literally millions of documents that we maintain and make free, most of them, throughout the website. People can go to our website and quickly and easily look up whether or not a business is a real business and who they're exactly. Right. And we make it available for free. Some states charge for that privilege.
Yeah.
But we make it free because we think it's important to allow commerce. We're very much into making business more efficient here in the state, and to the extent that we can, with our, you know, regulatory and administrative responsibilities, we try to do that.
Well, and when we think about it, too, because a lot of the businesses that may want to be issuers may never have taken the step to incorporate or become right. an LLC. Mm-hmm. And so now they're sole proprietor, and now they want to do this. And mm-hmm. so setting up and transitioning your legal entity from being a sole proprietor or maybe even a partnership into an entity that can issue stock or that can do
or
different
debt.
Or debt or royalty streams, whatever you're mm-hmm. going to do. But that's a step to come back and say, hey, let's go to the Secretary of State's website, sosnc.gov, and see what the legal entity types mean and which one may fit with that FAQ definition in there, and then look to see where that fits in mm-hmm. the crowdfunding or the other securities types of offerings and those exemptions, and then make a strategic decision with your lawyer, with your business consultant, right. with all those, your business partners, everybody that's engaged to say, how am I going to transition my business and which choices? I know many times I've been with clients that set up as a sole proprietor and then they were guided to be an LLC and then say they become a government contractor and an LLC is not necessarily the best entity for the research they're doing and things of that nature. And so then we're going for the third time or the fourth time to transition the legal entity type. And so when we make a strategic decision of I'm going to start my business or I'm already in business, I need to go to a different legal entity type, which one makes sense? I'm going to need funds. Which path am I going to go? And we start making those strategic decisions, but tapping into those free educational resources that are on your site right. or having you guys sit down with us and talk about that or come in and talk to, you know, mm-hmm. 20 or 30 people that are going to be involved with our business making that transition and explaining us what are our options.
Right. And you're exactly right. And as I mentioned, I'm very and willing to travel and come and talk on these or, you know, these kinds of topics. One thing I want to mention also, while we're sort of on the topic of the business registration, the law also in December, this past December, okay. Relating to doing business as the assumed business names of entities.
DBAs,
exactly. The legislature previous to December of last year, you had to, if you wanted to register your assumed name, you had to go to all 100 counties and register individually and pay separate fees individually. The legislature wanted a way for people to be able to to see who is behind this DBA. There was no registry, so they turned up because we have vast experiences with business registries, and we created a DBA registry. What people need to know is that they still register county register of deeds office to register right. their DBA. They need to check count fees. They can do 1, 2, 20, 30, one stop at their local registered deeds office, pay the one filing fee, and the information and uploads it behind the scenes into our database so that anybody can now look to see, you know, who owns a particular assumed business name. Now,
so that's raise a question because I, you know, as I do business with people, I have always gone to the county that they're in mm-hmm. at least to see if they've done their DBAs. What happens to businesses that are not a corporation, not an LLC? They're an individual operating under an assumed name, but they never take that step to do a DBA.
There are no protections for them. I mean, if they have not taken any steps to legally form their business or to register their assumed business name, then somebody can come along and take that name and start calling themselves, you know, whatever your name is.
ABC and, Inc., whatever.
Exactly. Right, yeah. And
or ABC, no Inc., but since they're not incorporated.
Right, exactly. So you lose any kind of protections that you may have. Now, assumed names, there is no right of exclusivity to that name. In other words, there can be multiple Fred's Plumbers,
right.
You know, in multiple counties. Yours just happens to be one. But, you know, we, with the registered DBA, somebody can go to our website, look that company up, look you up essentially, and determine which Fred's Plumber, you know, and who,
right.
who are the people behind it. So, I mean, there's an important thing there. Now, what the law gave a exemption period. In other words, if anybody registered their assumed business name properly, December of 2017, they have files in which to go back to their registered deeds office and apply for, you know, the assumed name again to refile. December of 2022, then you lose any sort of
protections
that you might have with an assumed business name.
Because a lot, I mean, like with Focus Resources, that was when I started the company in 2002, that was a generic, you know, there were a lot of Focus Resources around the country. And but with time, using that name, it became less generic with the logo and all of these kind of things. And so I ultimately got it trademarked in the version that I have for my categories. And so that's something everybody needs to be thinking of, too, because you're reserving your domain name on the internet initially. You're going to put that DBA in as a placeholder. You may want to register and reserve the name for your filing even later on to make it a non-sole proprietorship, those kind of things. And so, we need to be thinking about that and using the resources on the Secretary of State's website to understand why these things matter.
Yeah, and another thing, a way of seeing that it matters is maybe a little less obvious, is that, you know, you as a small you're building your brand. You're building your reputation and value based on, you know, the principles that you bring to your business, your ethics, your sense of quality control. Whatever your business is, you invest a lot of time, sweat,
right.
effort into it, okay? And so you want to take steps to protect that because somebody could come along and – you know, see that you didn't incorporate or whatever, and you may have this snazzy little logo that you're using that you haven't gone through the process of getting it trademarked and protected, and they could potentially come along and snatch that up, and then all the work that you did to build your brand and your customer satisfaction and all that
right.
good. Now, just sort of transitions over to this other person that may not share those
things. And then they send you a cease and desist
right.
when they register
yeah.
it, saying you can't use it anymore because it's protected.
That's a potentiality. Or at the very least, you're going to have to spend a lot of time, effort, and money in a court of law showing that you were the originator of this and that, you know, but that's an expense and distraction. And away from your business.
Right.
And the way I look at it is that is an inefficient use of your capital.
And your time.
And your time. And we are all about efficiency with the Secretary of State's office. So we do encourage people, you know, this stuff does matter. And it, you know, say you start off as that small business and you have a dream that one day you're going to be a Fortune 500 company or something. You know, you're starting along those lines. The value with your brand and your, you know, having a logo and stuff like that, all that has some intrinsic, you know, value to potential investors. I'll give you an example. In the coming out of the recession in 2008-2009, they basically put up their corporate brand, their logo, the Ford iconic logo. They put that up as collateral in order to secure loans that was able to allow them to go through, you know, the recession.
The awareness, yeah.
And, you know, they buy back, you know, they were successful in their transition through the rough patch, but they were able to buy back their brand, essentially.
Right.
And so what exactly how much, I don't know, but, you know, when it's something for a business to consider.
Well, and it fits with the conversation we had last week with the intellectual property attorney, is that yes, you might draw the image of your logo and it's copyrighted, but if you don't register it and if you don't take the next step and trademark it, those are the things that represent, especially in service companies, mm-hmm. where you don't have a tangible product that right. that you're patenting or those kind of things. That can be the make or break if you want to go to even to a bank to get lending,
sure.
as to how viable is this business? What is the likelihood that you're going to be able to repay a loan? Or in the conversation today, if we're going to go out and crowdfund, the potential investor or the potential person supporting it, the more that they know about that brand, the more that brand is perceived to be valuable, the more likely they're going to be reading your story and listening to it and want to go down that process of investing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
But it's important for us to interact with our Secretary of State's office in any of the states that we're in. Yeah. And it comes down to, it's a small expense that becomes an investment.
Yes.
Into protecting how and the nature of your business, who you are, your name, your brand,
right.
and your ability to access capital.
Yeah.
So when we're thinking about the portal, dealing with a broker dealer, how is it that your all's office screens those to say, yes, this portal meets the standard for North Carolina to do business in North Carolina and be involved in the PACES, you know, type offerings, or he's going to be a broker dealer, those kind of things. What's that screening process? What do people have to go through if they're thinking of becoming the second portal in the state or the second broker dealer?
In that, that's not my role in the division. But I mean, back and forth. There is a lot of discussion. You know, we look obviously to the legal authority, which is the statute. What does the statute say? You know, how must somebody operate within both the state and the federal statutes with regard to what a portal has to be? So there was a lot of discussion. I know our attorneys in the office have spent a great deal
with
of time
with their fine tooth comb.
And themselves, you know, to sort of, you know, making sure that they understand what the legal requirements are and all.
But is there just in general, I'm assuming there's an application process. They said someone, Secretary of State's Office, Securities Division,
yeah.
they come in and they apply, and it's probably on an FAQ somewhere on a.
Again, on our website. there is an FAQ specific to portals, and I don't have that in front of me at the moment. So
I can link to it.
But you can link to it. You know, it's probably less likely that you're going to that people want to be a portal. I mean, I guess. I mean,
I just know with our listeners, it's like, oh, I'm a programmer and I can do websites, and I hear there's only one portal. And so that says job versus opportunity.
Yeah, maybe. And we certainly don't want to discourage that. The more competition, the better. You know, in the 6 years, I guess, that the crowdfunding.
It's hard to believe it's been six.
Yeah, the crowdfunding passed in 2012, but the rules weren't in place until 2016. So how do you measure the time? But since it has become fully legal, you know, at the federal level, there are only 42 approved, you know, funding portals. You know, some of the capitalists is how does the portal make its money?
Right.
I mean, how does it charge for its fees? What can it do? I mean, so there are some
as to what the portal has to do, what rules you're obeying, how it's owned, you said, the fee schedules, how advertising or promotion takes place within those structures, within it, those kind of things. So so we'll point back to the statute.
I think that will sort of help answer a lot of the questions.
Do you guys get a lot of calls from, because you're doing the civil and the criminal aspect, do you get calls from investors after they've gone through, they've been made an investment? And how frequently do you get calls with investors that say, didn't get full disclosure?
Mm-hmm. I think it, the latest, I think, and I'm just sort of speaking off the top of my head here, I think we get between 300 and 400 complaints a year.
Not as many as I thought. But
Many. Significant. And I think we have anywhere, in excess of 100 active investigations at any given point in time. We stay busy. And a securities investigation can take quite some time. I mean, some cases, do speed along quickly. But, there's one victim, there's going to be more.
Right.
And we want to be thorough, and we try to follow leads where they go when we're in an investigation, trying to determine, information first and foremost. We have to determine, do we have jurisdiction in this case? And if so, how is the deal? What did the people do with the money that they collected? Did it go to productive investment activities, or did it just go in their pocket for personal expenses? The single thing they can do is to contact our office before they make an investment, because, as I said at the outset, the law basically says every issuer has to either be registered or qualify for an exemption.
And they have to file for the exemption.
And they have to notice file. Them to claim that they are entitled to the exemption. So the registered or qualify for an exemption, and the actual investment itself, the security that's being offered, has to be registered or qualify for an exemption. And so the individual is, there is a centralized database of registered issuers and registered securities, and we have access to that centralized database. And as I said, the single best thing that an investor can do to minimize their risk of being defrauded is to simply pick up the phone and call us at our toll-free number and ask to speak with one of our agents about the person that they're getting ready to be, to find out if that individual is registered or not. We can also tell them if there have ever been any complaints filed against that individual or any kind of regulatory actions. Very powerful information for people to know before they decide to do business. A lot of the problems that I have in our office stem from the fact that an investor invested with a person who is an unregistered seller of unregistered securities. Somebody that is a great flim-flam, somebody who can just talk you into
ice to an Eskimo.
Eskimo or exactly. A great con artist in some ways. And so some of the same tactics are used.
Several people pop into mind that are that I've encountered over the past decade or and a half. But when we're thinking about that and we make that phone call, what is the step that you guys take when we call and say, well, somebody is, it's Joe Smith of Smith's Plumbing or whatever, Smith's Printing, whatever, and they're offering this, and I'm getting ready to do it. Everything looks good. And you tell me, no, it doesn't exist. They're not registered. Nothing's there. And so on my end, everything comes full stop. I'm not going to make an investment. Does that trigger something on your end?
Yeah, it can, certainly. Yeah, we want to know about those kinds of situations and at least give us an opportunity to take a good.
Because like you said, if one person's doing it, there's bound to be a...
We're victims somewhere.
Unless you're just the first one.
Unless you happen to be the first. but we see that all the time, and it really breaks my heart. I mean, we've had some really, really sad cases. One over in Durham where a fella went after retiring school teachers. And, you know, I say he only, and I'm putting quotes around the word only, he only stole about $1.5 million from his victims, but they were all retired school teachers. And that was constituted their entire retirement fund. And they just didn't know that we existed.
Right.
For the purpose of helping them make informed decisions. They didn't know that they could call us. I'll give you our toll-free number, and I hope you'll put it on your
screen. Definitely.
It's 800-688-4507. 800-688-4507. It is really literally only a five-minute phone call, and it could save your entire retirement fund from being ripped off.
Well, and that's kind of – I'm going to jump back to one of the other things you talked about, the charitable solicitation registrations, mm-hmm. thing that the Secretary of State's office also oversees. That's also a place that I see a lot of people get taken by someone that's not – they're not registered. Right. They're not licensed to do this. And so is that another phone call we can make to a different part of the Secretary of State?
But you can find it easily. Yes. Just like investment advisors and broker-dealers have to be registered, those who seek to solicit charitable donations, the charities themselves, as well as the people that are their fundraisers, they all have to be registered with the Secretary of State's office too. And so, yes, that is another simple phone call to find out if that person, that organization exists. But we can go a little bit further with our charitable solicitations. We can tell people how much has that solicitor raised on behalf of the organization that they're soliciting for. How much have they turned over to that charity? How much have they kept for themselves? And it will surprise some listeners, or maybe not, that you know you'll get in some cases you'll get a solicitor who says, "Oh, we give you know." Of the proceeds to the charity, when in fact they may be giving 5 cents on the dollar.
Right.
I exaggerate a little bit, but not by much. And so, again, this is important. You know, Secretary Elaine Marshall, is, you know, every time she talks about this, she wants people to be generous donors.
They'll be wise.
Be smart about where you give. Take the 5 minutes to call to check to see if the charity is registered, if the solicitor is registered. Find out, again, how much are they giving and how much are they keeping so that you can make an informed decision. You know, ultimately, you may decide, yes, this is I'm fine with this. I support it. And you do it. But at least you're doing so from a perspective of having the information, of making an informed decision.
Well, if you can believe it, we only have a minute left.
Oh, my goodness.
Boy. So what's the one takeaway you want everyone to hear? Your favorite thing or the biggest thing that you guys see as a challenge, what's the one takeaway today?
The single takeaway, we alluded to it over and over, is to call our office, to check out the investment before you make the investment, to check out the person, the promoter, the charity, whoever. That really is the single best thing that people can do to minimize their chances of being defrauded. You know, the other takeaway is just be careful of people that sort of show up out of nowhere, who all of a sudden want to be your best buddy. you know, we didn't even scratch the surface about cryptocurrencies and all the online stuff. But it's a wild out there with some of these things. And, you know, the more kinds of interactions are the ones that you need to be careful about, too. If you're in a group, understand that people talk, bad guys talk, because the group mentality is that we trust one another that's right. In our group. And a bad guy will get into that group and pretend to be a member. And then sort of single out a person or two who might be deemed to be influential
right.
Within the group. And
somebody else has already checked that
exactly.
person out.
Exactly. And then that person's best promoter. So are really what we encourage people to call. To SNC.gov, play. The securities division has a lot of information. We have more than 40 different brochures or pamphlets that are free to download, certainly, and most of them I have in printed form. I'm happy to send them to you. Call me. Shoot me an email.
Invite him to come speak to your
group. Invite me to come. I do weddings and bar mitzvahs. And
Well, John Marin, thank you for being on the program today. And until next time, everybody, stay focused on the important things.